when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. This episode contains description of violence, including family violence. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, Lizzie.
Hello, Joe.
Welcome back.
Another episode.
This is part two on the case of Jeffrey Gillam, the miscarriage of justice case.
Yes. So you were getting into depth with this one, and I'm very interested to see what else you have to say about the potential miscarriage of justice in this case?
Well, it wasn't potential because the court found it as a miscarriage of justice. But let's do a quick recap. I mean, if you're just coming to this episode, perhaps you should listen to episode one. But just to remind everyone, because it's been a week since we talked about Jeffrey Gillam. So this is 1993 in a suburb in Botany Bay down in New South Wales. Three people are stabbed to death. Stephen Gillam, his wife Helen Gillam, and their 25-year-old son, Christopher Gillam. Now, Jeffrey Gillam, the only member of the family to survive, he says that he was alerted in the very early morning by an intercom from his mother. He runs into the house because he lived in a little boat shed out on the outside of the house to find his brother standing over his mother's dead body. And his brother said he'd killed his parents, and then his brother lit the mother on fire and she lit on fire, and then the father then caught on fire, the body of the father that was lying there, and then the house caught on fire. And Jeffrey said he then attacked his brother with a knife and stabbed his brother to death, and then went next door to, because the house was so smoky he couldn't do anything more, went next door, knocked on the door, and the neighbours answered, and police were called, blah, blah, blah. So he was charged with the murder of his brother on his own admission, but they convicted him of manslaughter after a plea deal. That's in 95. Cut to 2006, they bring a charge of murder against Jeffrey Gillam for his parents. And in 2008, they run a trial. They do the same trial twice because the first jury can't agree on whether he's guilty of murder. Second jury convict him in November of 2008, and he's sentenced to two life imprisonment. sentences, and then his conviction's overturned in 2012, finally, and he is out of jail. And the Court of Criminal Appeal in New South Wales goes through and points out a whole lot of problems with the prosecution, the case the prosecution led. So last time we talked about two of those problems, which I don't think you agreed were necessarily problems, but one of them was whether he should have been prosecuted, whether the prosecution should have been stayed, because in charging Jeffrey with the murder of his parents, when the prosecutors already accepted the manslaughter on the basis he'd been provoked by his brother, you know, who'd killed his parents, the prosecution was sort of, you know, blowing hot and cold, as it were.
Well, but as we discussed, it doesn't amount to double jeopardy.
No.
And obviously the Court of Appeal did not say it amounted to double jeopardy.
No, they did uphold the ground of appeal on a very limited basis, that yes, the directions that the judge gave to the jury in the trial about the acquittal for murder of his brother wasn't sufficient. Effectively, he should have sort of said more, because the jury didn't obviously place enough weight on it, something along those lines. But they rejected the Court of Criminal Appeal rejects this idea that it was any
type of double jeopardy, which I think is fair.
Yeah. They do talk about Carol, which is one of our earlier episodes, for any listeners who are interested in deep diving on that one, on double jeopardy.
Well, and since Carol, we've had the laws passed for double jeopardy amendments.
Yes.
Yes.
Then we also discussed the similarity in the stab wound. So I said in the first episode, Stephen Gillam had been stabbed 28 times, mostly in the front, in his chest.
That's the dad.
Some, that's the father, and some in the back. The mother had been stabbed, Helen Gillam had been stabbed 17 times in the all up. 13 of those were in the front and 4 of them were in the back. And Christopher Gillam had been stabbed 17 times, some in the back, but mostly in the front of his chest. And you, without me saying anything, admittedly sort of felt that there was a real connection between those, and that was actually argued at the trial and put to the jury, as and they called expert evidence about how the same killer must have done all three because of how similar they were. But that is then debunked in the appeal when they call another expert who is more of an expert than those experts, and he says no.
But when you say debunked, I know we are meant to leave this point, but when you say debunked, I mean, isn't it just that the Court of Appeal liked the evidence of this particular expert, and it could just as easily have been a different expert who got called and they could have liked that? I mean, it's very subjective, expert evidence.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's a 243-page judgment, so they go through it with a fine-tooth comb. But some of the complaints were that the evidence given was inadmissible, so they were ruling on the admissibility. And when you're doing that, it's not a matter of I prefer one expert over the other. It's as a matter of law that information should not have gone before the jury. And some of it I can't remember.
Because it wasn't credible or because it was prejudicial?
Yes, again, there's so many different arguments. So I think some of it they say is more prejudicial and probative. I think some of them they say that it was going beyond the expertise of the expert to give that evidence.
Because that also makes a difference. If they're saying it should have been inadmissible on a rule of evidence such as it's more prejudicial
or probative
than probative, that's not actually saying it's not good evidence, just that for whatever reason, it wasn't admissible in this matter. Mm. So that's a different proposition to not being credible.
Mm. Well, I think you should just read the decision around that issue. It runs for pages and pages and pages. But it would certainly answer the kind of questions I think that you've got about why the Court of Criminal Appeal chose to, Professor Cordner from South Australia's evidence over the two doctors.
Had he given evidence in lots of trials?
He has given evidence in lots of trials. I know Professor Cordner because I worked on a case, the Keogh case, in which he was one of the star witnesses again.
Well, no wonder you are inclined to accept him as the expert.
But he is the expert. That's the court. Everybody accepts that.
All right. Well, no. Anyway, disrespect to him. I just have issues with
you just don't like that. I like
cherry picking of experts.
Again, cherry picking. I just really repeating what the Court of Criminal Appeal said. But yes, okay. So here are the other issues. We'll see if we can get through these. So the prosecution said there was a lack of blood on the knife, and that indicated that Jeffrey Gillam had cleaned it. I'll come back to all these. So we'll just go through a quick list. That there was a lack of blood on Jeffrey Gillam himself that would suggest that he'd washed himself.
Hang on, so zero blood on the knife?
No, not zero. Not enough blood on the knife to have been involved in
three stabbings. Okay.
Which is a curious argument. Anyway, we'll get to it. Not enough blood on him to justify, anyway, again, I think a curious argument, but we'll come back to it. And then how quickly the fire spread. Okay, so as I said in the last episode, what the prosecution do is they run a case which is really debunking the story that Jeffrey Gillam tells. They don't actually try and prove that he committed the murders. They try and, well, they do that by debunking the story he gives.
I find it difficult to think that any judge at any level would let the prosecution get away with not actually proving the elements of the offence.
Well, I mean, this is exactly the complaint they made in Chamberlain. I said this last episode. I mean, Justice Murphy in the High Court in the Chamberlain decision just says you cannot run a prosecution case where you all you do is try and debunk the story that's given by the defendant. You have to run an actual positive case to show they committed the murder.
But what if in doing that it is debunking that case? Isn't that then again just a matter of perspective as how you want to characterise that case?
Mm. Well, possibly. Certainly Justice Murphy was in the minority in the Chamberlain decision because the High Court threw out the Chamberlain appeal and it wasn't until later that she had her conviction overturned. But let us not go down that rabbit hole. So I said we're going to look at lack of blood on the life, lack of blood on Jeffrey, and how quickly the fire spreads, because the prosecution said couldn't have spread as quickly as he said it did.
Meaning what? Like, what was their theory?
Well, which one do you want to do? Do you want to do that one now?
Yeah, let's start with the fire.
Okay, let's start with how quickly the fire spread. I should start with what the prosecution said happened.
Okay.
So they said that what happened is that Jeffrey Gillam had planned for 4 weeks that he was going to kill his parents and his brother, and that he had begun to set this up by complaining to his friends and his girlfriend that his brother was acting weird and that his brother had been arguing with his parents, particularly his father, and had started pushing his father around. And that Jeffrey was concerned about being around the house in case he had to intervene in a physical altercation between his brother Jeffrey and, his brother Christopher and the father.
And so that had happened? Like those conversations?
The conversations had happened, yeah, and yes. Evidence of those conversations comes out. But the prosecution runs
it. Said it was fabricated.
It's all lies. The other thing they said, they say on the night in question, he decides he's going to kill his parents and his brother. He doesn't go down to the boat shed and go to bed. What he does is he stays in the house, and he then, I can't remember what order they said he did it. I think they might have said he murders his parents and then he murdered his brother and then his parents, or he murders them in some order. He stabs them all to death. And then he decides he's going to light the house on fire to burn all of the evidence. And so they say he goes out to the garage and he tries to siphon petrol out of one of the tank of one of the cars that are parked there to use as an accelerant, but he can't siphon that petrol out. He has problems doing that. So he then goes in, gets the mineral turpentine, puts it everywhere and lights it on fire, goes down into the backyard, washes himself, goes through the backyard gate to the next door neighbors, the Warners, who we talked about in the first episode, and then goes and knocks on their door and then tells them this story, which he's made up.
So, all right. So, I mean, I guess I must have a little tiny bit of defense brain somewhere in there, because I listened to that. I think for someone who planned for 4 weeks so meticulously, you would have thought he'd get the accelerant
ready
first.
To go.
Yeah. Yes. That's the big flaw there that I see.
Yes. So the idea that he had washed himself and washed, you know, he's washing the knife and all of that kind of stuff is to, you know, so that it supports his story.
But how would that?
But that's the thing, I don't know, because it still doesn't support his story, because they say he doesn't have enough blood on him to have murdered his brother, but that's because he washed the blood off. But, you know, it's just, anyway, bizarre.
Yeah, that's an interesting, like, that I don't see as making any sense, because that's like grasping at straws, trying to.
Yeah, that's, I think, a good description of the prosecution case in this.
In that respect, I'm just giving you that respect.
Yeah, sure.
Because if he's admitted to stabbing the brother, why does it matter if there's blood on the knife or not?
Mm.
And why does it matter if there's Well, I suppose unless it's his parents' blood and he didn't check the bodies, so why would their blood be on him?
Mm. So the...
So was there blood on him?
Yeah, there was a little bit of blood. I'll get to that. But
no, the parents' blood.
Well, that's what I was about to say. It's 1993.
Ah.
You can't tell whose blood it is.
Oh, let's test it now.
They don't have it anymore. Mm. You see, because the whole case is closed in 95. They accept the decision to that he's done for manslaughter, and it all, I think some of it, I think gets destroyed. And so they do, they are able to test. So the brother, Christopher, when he dies, he's wearing like a robe. Yes. And they can test that, and they can do a test to see, I can't remember what the test was. I think it was whether it's O positive or A positive or whatever the blood types are. And they work out that the blood on Christopher's jacket is consistent with Christopher and the father.
Okay.
So it could be the father's, or it could be Christopher's, or it could be both.
Yes.
So that much that they knew actually is consistent with what Jeffrey had said.
Yes.
That Christopher had stabbed his father. But the anyway, I have so many problems with the scientific evidence. That's just the narrative around it. It gets worse when you actually delve into the evidence, you know, the scientific stuff itself.
Well, so I just want to make a disclaimer that I was not familiar at all with the detail of this case. So I'm responding to things as you tell me.
Yeah, good.
I have not in any way, shape or form made a decision that he actually did kill his parents. No. That's not where I'm heading. I'm just commenting on
And that's the beauty of this podcast. We can hear the prosecutor's thoughts as they occur.
Yes, as they occur.
Okay.
Priceless.
Priceless, that's right. We should charge money. All right, so you wanted to talk about the fire spreading quickly. Mm. So what the argument is that when Jeffrey says, I see my brother Christopher drop a match onto my mother's body, and she immediately lights up, and then it spreads across the floor really quickly. And by the time I get close enough that I can look into the bedroom, I can see my father's body, and it's already on fire or lights up soon thereafter. And so they do all these tests about how quickly turpentine burns, and they get an expert to say turpentine actually doesn't burn that quickly, and it would take more time. It wouldn't be in a few seconds. It'd be minutes.
So you don't like that expert?
No, because I don't like that expert because that just because as they point out, well, that depends on the fabric that the turpentine's poured onto, the amount of turpentine that's poured on there.
This is taking
you know, the
me
floor
back.
That goes, you know, what's the floor that the turpentine's poured on?
Oh, the arson trials.
Yes.
And the literally weeks of evidence that I could not always comprehend.
Well, I mean, trials and arson expert evidence is just an area ripe for miscarriage of justice because it is so, I think, untested. They have these theories which they've never tested, or they do these tests which don't take account, which is what this expert did. He does these tests which don't take account of a whole series of things.
They do have some expertise though, Joe. Arson experts.
Oh, I'm sure they have some level of expertise. Yes, they're expert at some things. I just find some of the conclusions they reach unbelievable. Anyway, one of the big issues that is that this expert does a whole series of tests, films himself doing the tests, and that is then played to the jury. And the appeal court says in the end it was more prejudicial than probative because it actually in the end wasn't that probative of anything and didn't really feature much in anybody's closing addresses, but it did support the prosecution's case to the extent that the prosecution said couldn't have burnt that quickly, and then they sit through this hours of this guy doing these tests, which seems to indicate the same thing. And so they said that was very prejudicial, particularly considering a whole lot of weaknesses in the tests that he did, than it was probative, and so it shouldn't have been led.
I don't know. I'm still stuck, I guess, a little bit on the not checking the parents. And
so we better remind people what that was because we talked about that last
episode. So Joe told us that he chose to either grab the knife or pick up the knife that his brother had just killed his parents with and then chased him down a spiral staircase, the brother stabbing him in the back, cornering him in the pool room and continuing to stab him. And he had not checked if his mother and father were in fact dead, or if he could do anything to save them or try to put out the fire. And that to me is an issue that I would think, that doesn't really gel with perhaps what I would do.
No, and I said two things to that. One, I think it's always very dangerous trying to predict how people should react in stressful situations. One shudders to think how one would react if we found our parents stabbed and on fire.
I know.
So we don't know how people should react. But the other thing I said is if a body is lying there and it's on fire and your brother's just said, I've killed them, you're probably pretty safe bet that they're dead because they aren't rolling around screaming because they're on fire.
I know, but he did anyway. I'm repeating myself, but he did see the body get set on fire.
Correct.
So it was quite fresh. And if he's saying it all happened very quickly, then maybe he could have, you know, if it's just happened, it's a new fire and he could maybe.
I have not ever been lit on fire, but I understand it's quite painful. That would track with the minor burns that I've had. So I would have thought if you were lit on fire, you know.
Well, I will tell you a funny story.
Yep.
One of my husband's friends, who I will not name, we used to camp quite a lot, and he did think he could walk on fire and went through the campfire. And look, that fire did go pretty quick on his leg.
Wow. Lit the hairs on his legs up.
Yeah, he had some injuries from that.
Wow.
So it's quick moving.
Was there alcohol involved?
Alcohol
at a perhaps campsite? What are you talking
so
about?
So I hear. I have no knowledge.
So that there were some other issues with the fire evidence in terms of how quickly it would have burnt, and the prosecution cases. It didn't. And this was what else I found inconsistent about the prosecution case. So we talked, I think, last episode about how the prosecution case is that Jeffrey Gillam goes to the garage, tries to siphon petrol from the car as an accelerant for the fire, doesn't do that successfully, so uses turpentine. They come up with that scenario in the face of accepting that it's turpentine that is the accelerant. It's like, well, why would you? I mean, they do that because they go into the garage and they find a hose that's been cut, and they find a jerry can full of, a jerry can with a little bit of petrol at the bottom of it. But Jeffrey Gillam said him and his father had earlier that day been trying to siphon petrol out of the car to use in the boat, and then realised it was the wrong kind of petrol. So the prosecution sort of seemed to bring up these stories, you know, only then to discount them. I mean, the petrol story doesn't even fit with the facts that they've got.
If they didn't bring up the fact that there was a jerry can with a little bit of petrol that had been siphoned from the car and didn't raise that at trial, and defense got hold of that information through disclosure somehow, they'd say, whoa, why did they not tell us about, where's the explanation for that? Like, it's again perspective.
Presumably they could ask their client, who'd say, Dad and I were just siphoning petrol.
But it's part of the scene that they are working through. These are the pieces of evidence that we found or discounted. And that's what the prosecution's meant to do,
put it all out there. Presumably there's lots of pieces of evidence that they
But that's pretty relevant because
what's in the fridge, for example?
That's different. Petrol is an accelerant. There was evidence.
But it wasn't the accelerant. Everyone knew that.
That's right. But if it was ignored, that would be something defense would say, well, why didn't they talk about the siphoned off petrol in the jerry can?
Yeah, I'm not sure they would.
Oh, of course they would.
Okay. All right. So that's a very broad brush about the fire spreading and about the difficulty of the fire spreading.
Yeah, okay.
So I might just pause here and just describe what happens when the fireys get there, because that's relevant to the next bit, which is the amount of blood that they, or lack of blood, they find on the knife.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So what happened when the fireys arrived? 28th of August, they arrive at 10 minutes after the call, which is pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah, 4:43 a.m. Okay. Fireys arrive. They try to go in the house. The fire's too strong at that point, but immediately a window blows out in the house because of some fire physics. I don't know.
Yeah.
So they then think, oh, that's great. So they just aim the hoses through the window, and that very quickly brings the fire under control. I can then go in and put the fire out.
Okay.
So the fire really has destroyed part of the upstairs area. Now downstairs area, no fire, but water damage. But
the murders took place. Murders
took place upstairs, and the bodies are quite badly burnt, but not badly enough burnt that they couldn't determine cause of death.
Yep.
So they determined that they had been stabbed and died from that, not from the the fire, mm-hmm. and they determined through the carbon monoxide in the bloodstream of the three deceased that they hadn't been alive at the time of the fire. So they'd been dead by the time the fire had started.
Okay.
But interestingly, the amount of carbon monoxide, although still within the ordinary normal level, the amount of carbon monoxide in Christopher Gillam's blood is higher than his parents' blood. And that then indicates that he could have been standing there lighting the fire, breathing in some of the carbon monoxide from the fire before he is murdered. It's consistent with that.
Okay.
So Christopher Gillam is stabbed.
But hang on, consistent yes, with.
Consistent with.
Yes. I mean, I don't know that I like that phrase either, consistent okay. with.
Well, the prosecution uses it all the time, so I don't know.
Well, I know, but it's like, you know, the hair was consistent with.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Yeah, whatever.
I think it's a bit of a nothing.
I will remember that you said that next time a prosecution expert uses consistent.
I think I am consistent with my opinions.
There's no doubt about that.
Anyway.
Okay.
All right.
So Jeffrey Gillam has found his body's found downstairs next to the pool table.
Christopher.
Sorry. Christopher, this is why we have to do it in two, so that correct. You can pick up on these things. Mm-hmm. Christopher Gillam's body is downstairs next to the pool table, and he has been stabbed to death, and next to him is a knife. Now, it's agreed that that is the knife that killed all three
yes.
of the Gillams. They try and get some fingerprints off it, but unsuccessfully. But they then
it wouldn't matter anyway.
No. Well...
Oh,
I suppose
yes.
if it had Christopher's
if it didn't have Christopher's fingerprints.
And if it did have his on it, then... But it was a knife from the kitchen. So, I mean, yeah. again, I don't know why it would have made
much sense. They all probably had touched it.
Yes. Again, in an argument which I can't actually sort of work out how it all fit together properly, the prosecution, except insofar as they're trying to discount what Jeffrey Gillam said.
Yes.
The prosecution run this case that the knife had been washed because it doesn't have enough blood on it to justify the three stabbings. So that because their story was that Jeffrey Gillam had planned to burn the whole house down so there was no evidence, and that he obviously, I don't know, their story was that he'd washed the knife and washed himself. So washed some blood off himself, washed blood off the knife, lit the house on fire, and then gone next door and, I don't know, the fireys had turned up and put it out before it had really got going. So
okay, so... In washing the knife,
yep.
the prosecution are alleging that he was trying to do what?
I don't know, cover up his murder. See, this is my point. They're really just trying to show that anything he said
like
was a
that
lie.
That would have to be very sophisticated thinking to say that he washed the knife so that if the brother's fingerprints weren't found, there was a reason why that was. Like, that's the only thing I can...
Yeah.
Think.
Yeah.
Mm.
So they get all these experts in to talk about blood on the knife. Now, and this is immediately my issue. I've seen in miscarriage of justice cases, long delay or delay between the incident occurring and the trial. And in cases like this, the problem is that the experts who are looking at the knife and making and giving their opinions are working, they're not working with the actual knife. It's not there anymore, they don't have it. What they are working with you know, 12 years later, they are working with the descriptions given by the two scenes of crimes officers who go down and look at Christopher Gilman's body in the scene, and the forensic pathologist who does the autopsy, because he has the knife, because he has to connect it to the wounds. They get their verbal descriptions, and then they look at a photocopy. Interestingly, the forensic pathologist put the knife on the photocopier and photocopied one side of it. Yeah, I know. And a photograph of the knife in situ. So you know that scenes of crimes officers will turn up and they will take photographs of everything they see, including close-up photographs of things and where they're lying.
Yes.
And so
they
number them all. That's right. And often put a little measuring stick next to them so you can see how big things are. So there's a photograph of the knife in situ taken by the scenes of crimes officers. So the photograph, the photocopy, and then these verbal descriptions given by these scenes of crimes officers is given to some experts, and they're asked to comment on whether there's enough blood on that to have been involved in stabbing three people or if they think it's been washed. I automatically would have just objected to that right there. You know, I just think that they just have not enough information to be making any kind of sensible judgment on
that. Yeah, I do struggle with the point of that.
Yeah. Hmm. So
particularly as there's no doubt that the knife killed three people.
Yeah.
That was not in doubt.
Yeah.
So blood or not is irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, the idea is, has it been washed? Yeah, should it have more blood on it? It's been washed. Well, because Jeffrey Gilman says it hasn't been washed. But it gets worse than that. This is downstairs in the house. Upstairs in the house, the fireys had been pouring water.
Of course.
Through the place.
Yeah.
And so then there's all this, oh, there wasn't enough water to wash off the knife. So to Christopher Gillen's body is wet.
Yeah.
The knife's lying next to him and they're like, oh, but it's not enough to wash blood off. And they're asking experts 14 years, you know, years later.
Yeah, I think that was an error to focus on that at all.
But it just seems like shake your head kind of stuff. Like, yeah. How was this even, how is anyone taking any of this seriously?
I don't know who came up with that line of evidence.
No, I agree.
No.
So then there's evidence about amount of blood. So they say Jeffrey Gilman himself doesn't have enough blood on him because he washed himself before he, you know.
But so he was only wearing boxer shorts.
He's only wearing boxer shorts.
And so was there any evidence from Mr. Warner as to blood on Jeffrey when he came to raise the alarm?
Yes.
What did he say?
Or Mrs. Warner. I think Mrs. Warner gives some better evidence about that. So they don't initially see blood on him, but then on closer inspection, because he's in their company then for sort of 10, 15 minutes, they notice some blood. So they notice some blood on his feet. They notice some blood on one of his shins, and they notice some blood in the quick of his fingernails, just in the side of maybe one finger or a couple of fingers. And I think Mrs. Warner said the blood on his shin didn't look like it was. It looked like it had sort of been wet or washed off. It was a pinky color. It wasn't red blood.
Red. Yeah.
There was evidence about, well, was the blood on his feet enough to justify what he'd said had happened? That he'd sort of seen his you know mother's dead body, and then he'd chased his brother and stabbed his brother. And the problem was they couldn't get any real idea about how much blood's around on the floor because the upstairs had been burnt.
Well, surely
your
expert in stab wounds would have had some knowledge of
amounts of blood,
spray, and you know.
Well, he didn't give evidence on blood spray pattern. They'd had another expert do that, and again, I just think that I'm blood spray pattern, you know, evidence. I think has always got to be treated very carefully because. You know, because there's no spray pattern. They're not going, and it's not like everyone, nobody knows how the people died. Everyone knows how they died.
Yeah, but it comes down to things like left or right hand or the position of the victim juxtaposed with the accused and the heights and that sort of thing. I think that's all got some valid base to evidence relating to those things.
Well, I mean, nobody was in dispute about who'd stabbed Christopher Gilman.
Jeffrey no, but the Gilman amount of blood on him, had he also stabbed his parents, I'd be interested to know what would the expected spray from 28 and 17 stab wounds, what would that be?
Yes. Interesting. I didn't see anything about spray from those, you know, from hitting an aorta or something like that. It's an interesting, I hadn't thought of that.
I can't see how you could inflict that many stab wounds and not be covered.
In blood. In blood. Well, yes. There was some conjecture about how much blood you would get. So what they did is they said, and again, I think this is always dangerous. They get a forensic pathologist and they say, you know, you've done stabbing cases. Do you think there should have been more blood on the knife? And she's like, yeah, I think there should have been based on the stabbing case. You know, and they get some police officers. I've seen lots of stabbing murders and stabbings and, yeah, there definitely should have been. That kind of, you know, anecdotal, you know, you're an expert by experience, I think can be really dangerous. You know, because what happens exactly in the sort of the patterning of the stab wound cases is you get an expert who comes along who's actually looked into it and done a study of it and goes, yeah, there's absolutely, you can't tell anything from these stab wounds. They're all stabbings are pretty much like that. So anyway, so that's the kind of evidence I get about blood on the knife, that, oh, there should have been more blood on the knife. But as I say, they're looking at these photographs, this, you know, and they sort of discount the fact that water had been pouring through from upstairs on the basis that there wasn't enough. Yeah, so the scenes of crime officers were like, oh, there wouldn't have been enough. It's like, well, you know, and the scenes of crime officers aren't taking much notice of the knife. They arrive, they set up a scenes of crime, they're like, oh, yeah, there was a knife there. You know, have much blood on it.
Well,
yeah,
had weird. Some blood.
Well, I can understand that in that they're sort of there securing the scene. And don't forget they've gone in. Yeah, they've gone in afterwards. So this is sort of...
Yeah, but the fire was, you said, not so problematic on the ground floor where Christopher is.
I don't think it was
is.
On the ground floor at all, yeah.
Yeah, so Christopher's down there stabbed 17 times with the knife next to him. I'd say that's pretty crucial evidence.
Yeah, but I suppose at that point they don't know they're going to be asked how much blood was on the knife. So they're not sort of taking note of that. They're taking note, there's a knife sitting next to him, got that. Let's take a photo of it. Yep, secure the scene. You know, let's take a photo of, you know. His...
I don't know. I would have thought the knife was fairly crucial to.
I think it's crucial, but being asked how much blood was on the knife.
Well, I don't see the relevance of how much, but unless all they're trying to do is prove him a liar, which is what they tried to do.
Yeah. Sorry, I went back to the knife because we were talking about blood on Jeffrey Gillingham himself. So the Warners who see him, the next door neighbours who he runs over to, they give a short description about how much blood's on him. I don't know really why that was relevant because the police arrived shortly after that and, you know, the police see him. And, I mean, I don't know what the process was in 93, but, I mean, nowadays you're taking the police station, you're immediately photographed, every inch of you, any blood on you, any spots of blood's immediately photographed. And
I just saw on the TV because we just had our by-elections down here.
Yes, yep.
And one of our members of parliament was the fellow who got charged with killing his stepfather last year.
Oh, yeah.
And he's running again and they put the footage again of when he got arrested and honestly he looked like hazmat. He was completely covered in plastic to foot when he was being brought out from the crime scene. Yeah. So they preserve everything.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's difficult. It's hard to – it's not entirely fair to judge 1993 by these standards. But
true.
You would have thought that there would have been reasonably soon after he, you know, photographs would have been taken of him.
Yeah. Look, I'm curious about all of that. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, what I'm most curious about is we can pick apart these things in the prosecution case, but that decision to charge him and try him, however many years later, third investigation into the matter, like what was the impetus?
Well, I think the impetus was the uncle. Tony Gillam is Stephen Gillam's brother.
But how often would a police officer, I mean, gosh, we have enough cases where people have gone to police saying, please look into this, please investigate, please charge, and police are like, oh, well, we have to do our job. Like, why would that be enough in this case?
I don't know. Some people are very convincing. I mean, you know, some people, I don't know.
It seems unusual if that was the determining factor that the uncle says, particularly in light of the little thing I read that shows there may have been financial motivation for him to point the finger at Jeffrey.
Well, he is, you know, going to inherit from his parents in any event. So, I mean, the fact that his parents die and he then inherits, I mean, I don't
know. No, financial motivation for the uncle.
Because he might inherit instead of the
child. Well, if there's no one else, where does the, like, probate would go to the next of kin?
Who might be the uncle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in light of all of that, that is, I mean, I understand your issues with some of this expert evidence. I see that, you know, you can pick it apart. But my bigger question is why did they, or how did they justify the charge and the trial 11 years later, you know?
Well, I don't know, but I can say that I have seen another commonality between this case and some other miscarriage of justice cases is the idea of a family members or interested parties pushing police and prosecutors on to run a prosecution. So, you know, that was a feature in the Henry Keogh case where, you know, family members really pushed for a prosecution.
Mm.
And again, similar case in that there was...
But I mean, a little difference is that they had a murderer.
Mm. Well,
in this case, you know what I mean? No, the brother.
Mm.
Like it wasn't a question of if not him, then who?
Yeah.
It was a question of he did this one.
Yes.
Because the brother did those ones. Yeah. You know, like it wasn't a whodunit.
No. No, but I suppose, you know, it all relies on you believing Jeffrey Gillam because he, you know, what we know is there's three dead bodies in that house and they're all stabbed to death with the same knife.
Mm.
So you can either say Jeffrey Gillam stabbed all three of them or Christopher Gillam stabbed two of them and Jeffrey Gillam stabbed Christopher Gillam.
Yeah.
So, you know, that... I mean, if we look at Occam's razor like I like to and say the simplest answer is probably the most correct one, in the simple way I've just put it, you would have thought, oh, well, Jeffrey Gillam's the obvious person.
Yeah.
He just killed all three of them. That's a bit easier. It's a more simple answer than Christopher Gillam kills two of them.
Yes. It's less dot to dot.
Yeah. But when you actually unpack it, the knots that the prosecution had to tie themselves into to get these bits of pieces of evidence here and there and then thread them into a story which defeats Jeffrey Gillam's story, you know, was just crazy because they end up having to do things like saying, oh, yeah, the petrol can, I know petrol wasn't part of it, but it's still evidence of his guilt. It's like, what? You know, it just is the most convoluted story.
I think what I would like is to talk to, which will never happen, but I would like to talk to the police officer who interviewed him in 93 and accepted the people who accepted the plea to the manslaughter and then the person who eventually decided to charge and try him for the murder of the parents and say, okay, what are we missing here?
Yeah.
What was different from here to here?
Yeah, well,
It can't just be Uncle Tony.
Uncle Tony. Well, you know, I mentioned in the first one that 60 Minutes did an episode in 97, which I haven't seen. But my guess is that 60 Minutes came up with or 60 Minutes were given some, you know, people love a bit of forensic evidence, a bit of scientific evidence. There's some scientific evidence because there's a lot of scientific evidence in this case. We're just touching on it, you know, particularly about how quickly the fire would have spread. And
you know, look, I can be a little bit skeptical about your concerns because I think some of those things are understandable or explainable or whatever. But we need to come back to the fact that if this, and the Court of Appeal has said it is, if this is a miscarriage of justice against him, I mean, that day he lost his parents in the most traumatic way ever. He immediately accepted responsibility for what he did to his brother in response. And I guess that kind of gets lost because he, you know, that was his life irrevocably changed on that day as well. So, you know, I am Well, I have a big heart, and I feel like if this is the miscarriage of justice that it has been deemed, then we should all be very apologetic to Gillam.
Yeah.
And thank God he's no longer languishing in prison. But I don't know that I agree with all of your concerns about the case necessarily.
No, well, I mean, some of the concerns I've raised are concerns that the Court of Criminal Appeal didn't accept. So there was 18 grounds of appeal. I think he only won on sort of three or four of them.
That's all you need.
That's all you need. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Prosecution discretion is an interesting thing.
Yeah, they have an enormous appeal that is, I didn't look at how long it ran for, but it must have run forever, 18 grounds of appeal, which is just phenomenal. And they took a long time to put it together, I gather, because he's convicted at the end of 2008, and he's sentenced in the beginning of 2009. And then his appeal isn't heard until 2011, I don't think. And it's the end of 2011 when he is, I think they give a decision that he's acquitted, but they don't give orders about whether he should be retried. And in fact, the court is split about whether he should be retried. So three judges sit. The most senior judge felt he should be retried. So that means that that judge felt that although that the prosecution case, had problems, there was enough in it that it should go back to another jury. For a third time, it would have been. The other two judges said no, it shouldn't, and he should be acquitted. So no retrial.
No.
But it wasn't, they agreed. The funny thing is they all agreed on the reasons, but they all agreed on the problems. All of the problems in the case was a joint decision of the court. They gave separate reasons as to whether there should be a retrial or an acquittal.
Yeah, I guess part of that is the, preserving the function of the jury.
Yep.
But also, I guess, just because there are identifiable issues within a prosecution case, like you said, not all of the grounds were successful. So that doesn't mean that the whole case is necessarily unrunnable.
Mm.
So, you know.
I just think there's Jeffrey Gillam's story had a couple of, he said slightly different things on a number of occasions. But he stuck to the main parts of his story from the moment he walked through the Warner's door, that morning to, 15 years later when he's giving evidence in his trial. The main parts are exactly the same.
That is great
and
does often indicate truth. It's not a complex story. He didn't have a lot to remember.
No.
It's not like it was this day and on this occasion and this person said that. It is pretty straightforward what he said happened.
Yeah.
Not a lot of room. He didn't even have a story about seeing them being stabbed or anything like that.
No.
So.
And he didn't have much of a story about, not that I think in his trial he gave a story about his brother because he said he couldn't really remember the stabbing of his brother.
Convenient.
Well, that's consistent with being in a rage, being provoked to the point where you can't form an intention. as we discovered last episode. Yes. All right. Well, I'm glad that I've introduced you to this case. It's probably a bit ghoulish to say, but it is one of my favourite cases. It's got so much in it.
Well, yes. And I think thanks to you, my students will get the benefit of this. I'm running Miscarriages of Justice next semester.
Yeah, well, don't make them read it. 243-page judgment.
Oh, cherry pick.
Cherry pick. Lovely. That's my favourite thing to do. All right. Well, thanks, Lizzie. Look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you, Joe. Very good.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.